KSFR programming and podcasts are made possible by the financial support of our listeners. If this program is important to you, please consider making a contribution by clicking on the red Support This Station button at the top of our homepage at ksfr.org.
Welcome to Here and There, where our name is our game. We search near and far to bring you accurate, timely information about important news stories here in New Mexico and the American Southwest, and there, everywhere else. I'm Dave Marish. You know that term, Banana Republic? Well, before it was a brand name for a clothing store, it was a label for a country that retained some of the forms of Republican democracy, but was in reality a poor place simultaneously being looted and ruled by a strong man and his cadre of supporters. The original, and maybe still the pluperfect Banana Republic, was Guatemala, where the defining year of its modern history was 1954, when an overwhelmingly popular elected leader named Jacobo Arbenz was tossed out in an American-supported military coup after he had been successfully red-baited to Washington by the banana cartel called United Fruit. Arbenz's U.S. anointed successor, Carlos Castillo Armas, resurrected 40 more years of military dictatorship and genocidal war against indigenous peoples, who were also constantly being represented as communist dupes to Americans. You could call Honduras a banana republic, but the continental America's poorest, most violent country was really never more than a second banana, a minor player. That pothole on the Pan-American Highway, the country's great poet Roberto Sosa once described Honduras to me. Significantly, the title of Sosa's three prize-winning books are The Poor, Difficult Days, and The Common Grief. Honduran politics has had several poisoned gifts from the USA. The worst, probably, was Gustavo Alvarez Martinez, installed by the Reagan administration as head of Honduras's armed forces and chief aide in the American fight in the Contra War. He'd been trained in Argentina in the fine arts of disappearing citizens, torturing dissidents, and coddling criminal syndicates. The next worst, probably, and much more present-day effective, was the coup in 2009, which President Obama publicly denounced, but then pressed the rest of the world to accept. Among its byproducts have been 6 years of increasingly ineffective leadership, economic decline, and the kind of military police and gang violence and impunity which has installed Honduras as the world's capital of murder. That's all history. Recently, things have gotten even worse, with revelations in both Guatemala and Honduras that the education and health systems have been completely gutted by, prosecutors in both places say they are ready to prove, conspiracies directed by top elected officials and their top aides. Both presidents, Otto Perez Molina in Guatemala and Juan Orlando Hernandez in Honduras, say they're innocent. They didn't know anything about what their, well, vice presidents, for example, to name just two of the accused ringleaders, were doing. For the past couple of months, the capital cities, Guatemala City and Tegucigalpa, have been filled with thousands of angry citizens whose feeling might be summed up in one word: enough. Our guest today, freelance journalist Louisa Reynolds, has been based in Guatemala City for 8 years. She's been published by Foreign Policy, the Economist Intelligence Unit, Christian Science Monitor, and is presently an Elizabeth Newfer Fellow, which, among other honors, has put her onto the pages of the New York Times and Boston Globe. Louisa, thanks so much for joining our conversation.
Hi, David. It's great to talk to you today.
Now, the people's hate affair with their governments in Guatemala and Honduras has been building up for a while in Guatemala, so much so that in 2007, public pressure helped to force the government to accept a crime-fighting investigative mission from the United Nations. And what they have found, and to a large degree been able to prove, has maybe set the stage for a big shift in the balance of political power in Guatemala. Tell us first about CICIG, CICIG, as it's known, what it's done and the impact it's had inside Guatemala.
CICIG has been a very innovative experiment because really it's the first time that the UN has done anything like this anywhere in the world. I mean, really the UN was getting into totally uncharted territory when they decided to create CICIG. And as you rightly pointed out, it all came from pressure from civil society. And it started with another scandal, another major scandal under the administration of President Oscar Berger. That scandal originated due to the murder of four Salvadoran congressmen in Guatemala who were allegedly involved in drugs. And their charred bodies were found a couple of miles away from Guatemala City. And it turns out that they were murdered by an elite police squad. And the policemen who were charged with the murder were kept in what was supposed to be a high security prison, but were brutally murdered while they were in prison. So it was a very high profile case. It was known as the Parlacen case because these were deputies from the Central American Parliament known as Parlacen. That was really the case that acted as a catalyst for change under the Berger administration, and that's when Guatemala started talking about the creation of CICIG. And it wasn't until the administration of Pérez Molina's predecessor, Álvaro Colom, that CICIG actually came into force. And it has had some very notable achievements, such as solving the Rosenberg case, which was the case of prominent Guatemalan lawyer who masterminded his own murder, as crazy as that can sound, to try to pin the blame on President Álvaro Colom and former First Lady Sandra Torres, who's currently running for office this year. So that was one case. There's been a number of cases involving drug traffickers associated to the Mexican cartel Los Zetas. And there's been a number of cases solved regarding death squads run by the police. Really, it's been an institution that has managed to earn respect from civil society and pro-transparency organizations. It has had its enemies as well. Its detractors argue that it's something that infringes on Guatemalan sovereignty. And I'd like to stress that part of CICIG's mission is not just to come to Guatemala and impose order, as it were, or start arresting people involved in alleged corruption cases. Its main mission is to train Guatemalan prosecutors so that when it eventually leaves, because obviously CICIG can't remain in the country forever. So the idea is that when CICIG eventually leaves and its mandate comes to an end, that the Guatemalan institutions can take on that role and that they will have received the appropriate training to do so. And that, of course, in the long term, will be the major challenge for Guatemala.
Luisa, before we get to the present big revelation, big case that CICIG has been working on, let's note that the pressure that their latest investigations has brought on President Pérez Molina has, among other things, produced a second term for CICIG. Its first term was to expire later this year, but President Pérez Molina has now perhaps somewhat reluctantly, agreed to extend the mission for how long?
For another 2 years.
Now, if you, and again, we will get to the La Linea case, which is presently roiling politics and people in Guatemala, but give us a sense of the resources that CICIG has and how they use them both as an investigative unit and as a training force to try and reform police and criminal justice in Guatemala.
Well, I think its main resource is human resources. The fact that one of the major problems that the Attorney General's office and that Guatemalan prosecutors have is that they're simply so overworked. Because if you think of the crime rates in Guatemala is one of the most violent countries in the world. And you talk to many of these prosecutors and you go to their offices and you see that they're buried in paperwork and they have a crazy workload to deal with. And one of the things that CICIG has done is that it's focused on these high-impact cases and has simply assigned the right number of human resources to deal with each of these cases. And so it's not like they're coming here with some amazing technology and they're doing something superhuman that has never been done elsewhere. It's simply a question of allocating enough prosecutors to work on these high-impact cases. They've actually been quite secretive about what they do in terms of it's not an institution that likes to trumpet its achievements, as it were, and that they keep the cases that they're working on in a very sort of secretive manner, and you never really know what they're working on until all of a sudden there's a major arrest, like La Linea case. And that then the media and everybody else finds out what they've been doing. So I think it's more than anything a question of allocating enough human resources and just making use of things, resources like CCTV footage and others have been vital for solving a number of cases like the Rosenberg case, for instance. And really, I think its major achievement has been for ordinary Guatemalan citizens to realize that justice can't be done, that before justice was this abstract concept for people and everybody assumed that these cases couldn't be solved, and CICIG has come here and has shattered that myth. Another major achievement was its attempt to prosecute former President Alfonso Portillo, who served a jail sentence in the U.S. for attempting to launder the proceeds of a Taiwanese bribe through U.S. banks. And unfortunately, that case fell apart in court, not because it wasn't argued properly or anything like that, but it fell apart because, as you know, there's a lot of corruption in the judiciary in Guatemala, and it was a verdict that was very hotly contested, but then subsequently Portillo was extradited to the U.S. And he received a sentence there, and he's now back in Guatemala and he's running for Congress. I think its major achievement has been for people to realize that no one is untouchable in Guatemala and that justice can be done. Because, for example, as part of the La Linea case, it hasn't only been government officials involved in the tax Internal Revenue Service. There's also been a number of judges who have been arrested as part of the CICIG's investigation, a number of corrupt judges who are receiving bribes, and that has actually been explicitly proven by CICIG. They received bribes in exchange for giving some of the major defendants in the La Linea case.
Luisa, let me sort of frame this up, if you will. The present big case that CICIG, the UN-created trainer of and enactor of criminal investigations of the highest sort, was that they unmasked a conspiracy that was called La Linea, and which one has been operating literally for decades, and operating from the level of the smallest customs office in the dustiest town on the border, right on up to some of the highest elected and appointed officials in the government of Guatemala. Would you fill in the blanks on that outline on La Linea?
Sure. Yes, basically, La Linea was, La Linea, by the way, means the line. And the reason why it's called the line is because there was allegedly a telephone line where people used to call and they would have access to various different officials involved in this network. So the way that it's operated, as you rightly pointed out, it began from the smallest, lowest level customs officers who were in charge of inspecting containers that arrived at the border. And it went all the way up to Juan Carlos Monzón, who was the private secretary of former Vice President Roxana Valdetti, who was forced to step down on May the 8th as a result of this scandal. So it was a huge structure, and as you pointed out, it's something that has existed in Guatemalan customs offices all the way back in the 70s. And what's interesting there is that all these corruption structures that existed in the customs offices in Guatemala, they began during the period of the Civil War, during the military dictatorship. So it's something that sort of comes around full circle, that now that Pérez Molina is in power, the whole corruption situation in customs became a lot worse. And really, I think one of the interesting things, one of the reasons why people felt compelled to take to the streets to protest against this particular case, because sometimes I've been asked, well, how come in a country that is so used to corruption scandals, why did this case in particular generate such a reaction from civil society? Why are people protesting about this case in particular? And the reason is that throughout the Pérez Molina administration, his administration has been dogged by underfunding problems and by falling tax revenue. It's been a problem, a major problem for his administration, to the point that back in 2013, Pérez Molina sent the army to intervene in the various different customs offices on the Guatemalan border, which is hugely ineffective because sending a battalion of soldiers to patrol a customs office really won't do anything in terms of boosting tax revenue. So it was more than anything a smokescreen or something that he did to try and prove that he was this strong man who was dealing with the issue of falling tax revenue. And it was really something that was very strongly felt by the Guatemalan population in terms of the fact that that there was this huge shortfall in tax revenue meant that there was a shortage of gas for many police stations in Guatemala. Like, for example, in the Northern Department of Huehuetenango, people would ring the emergency services and they would be told that their call couldn't be answered because the local police station had no gas to go and deal with emergency calls. Or, for example, the hospitals, the major hospitals in Guatemala City, were in a really terrible state. I mean, these are problems that have existed for years. I mean, as you know, Guatemala has huge problems with regards to public health care. But really, under this administration, it reached an all-time low. I mean, to the point that vendors from the Guatemala City Central Market were taking food to the San Juan de Dios Hospital because the hospital had run out of food. and they had no way of feeding the patient.
And so many of these deficits were due to the fact that La Línea, which was offering, I guess, a 40% discount on customs to all people who were in on the conspiracy, was literally draining tens of millions of dollars from the economy, and those drained dollars were the very ones that were not reaching the hospitals, the schools, and the gas pumps of the police departments.
Exactly, yes. So it was these two factors, the fact that ordinary Guatemalan citizens were witnessing these shortages and were suffering greatly as a result of these shortages. And then at the same time, the media had widely reported the personal enrichment of Vice President Roxana Valdetti and a number of high-level government officials. Vice President Valdetti had refused to disclose details of her personal income, and it was obvious that her fortune vastly exceeded her income as vice president and her personal businesses, because she was the owner of a chain of spas. And it was obvious that somebody who owns a small chain of spas and couldn't be making that kind of money. I mean, it was millions and millions of dollars that were being spent on private helicopters, lavish properties. Particularly El Periódico newspaper had given wide coverage to this issue of personal enrichment, particularly from Vice President Roxana Valdetti and her private secretary Juan Carlos Monzón, who disappeared mysteriously when the La Línea scandal broke out, while the vice president was on an official trip to Korea.
Well, you know, when the vice president is forced to resign and her top aide suddenly disappears, the next question that almost everybody in Guatemala is asking is, well, what about the president? What about Otto Pérez Molina? There are some new answers, or at least new developments on that front. We'll talk about them next, but right now we're going to take a pause. This is Here and There. I'm Dave Marish, and our guest is Louisa Reynolds, a freelance correspondent based in Guatemala City. And we're talking about what may be the predicate for democratic political upheaval, a Central American spring, if you will, in Guatemala and next door Honduras. We'll deal with that right after these messages.
KSFR programming and podcasts are made possible by the financial support of our listeners. If this program is important to you, please consider making a contribution by clicking on the red Support This Station button at the top of our homepage at ksfr.org.
Welcome back to Here and There. I'm Dave Marish. Our guest is Louisa Reynolds, a news correspondent based in Guatemala City, where for the past couple of days, most of the talk has been focusing on President Otto Pérez Molina, himself a former general who was elected on an anti-crime promise that he was going to clean things up. He certainly has failed in that and maybe done much worse. And the word impeachment is in the air. What are the latest developments on the threat of impeachment for President Pérez Molina?
Well, the impeachment process in Guatemala is quite long and complex. So the way it works is that first Congress has to decide whether or not are sufficient grounds to strip the president of his prosecutorial immunity. And then after that, a penal court would have to decide whether or not there are sufficient grounds for the president to be put on trial, in this case for corruption, in which case he would be forced to step down. So what happened a month ago was that Congressman Emil Carpop from the indigenous WINAC party put forward a motion to the Supreme Court arguing that there was enough evidence to prosecute Otto Pérez Molina. And the reason being that not only was he in charge during the period when some of his most trusted high-level officials were directly involved in the La Línea scandal, there are also a number of recordings published by CC, where various individuals involved in the La Línea scandal actually mentioned somebody that they refer to as the president. And they don't explicitly say Pérez Molina, but who else could they be referring to as a president? But there are also a number of recordings that have been interpreted as referring directly to former Vice President Roxana Modesti, because they talk about La Señora, the lady, La Dos, number two, La R, referring to her initial letter R. And then there's these other recordings that that mention the president. So all of this has been taken as evidence of Pérez Molina's possible direct involvement in the case, or that at the very least he knew what was going on.
Well, also being tossed onto the scale against the president is a much smaller scandal, but it involved awarding a contract for dialysis services to the national hospital system to a company that was utterly unqualified in dialysis, but it appears that they paid off the then head of the Guatemalan Social Security System, who happened to be the former private secretary, that's the sort of top civil service aide and confidant of President Pérez Molina.
Exactly, yes. Really, it was quite unfortunate for the Pérez Molina administration, because the La Línea scandal was motivating thousands of people to take to the streets protesting against him and demanding that he should step down. And then right in the middle of that, CSIG uncovered the Social Security scandal, and another 20 or so top-level officials were arrested, including Juan de Dios Rodriguez, who was the individual that you just mentioned, who was Pérez Molina's former private secretary. And what's interesting there is the way that Juan de Dios Rodriguez was appointed, because he was appointed 2 years ago after the former president of the Social Security Board was forcibly removed by the army in almost like a sort of military coup-style operation after he was involved in a sex scandal. So after Luis Reyes Mayen, the former president of the Social Security Board, was forcibly removed by the army, then Pérez Molina appointed Juan de Dios Rodriguez. And at that moment, he expressed that he had full trust in Rodriguez, that he had known him for years. And Rodriguez, actually, a number of years ago, served under the military intelligence unit known as G2, and was part of a group of military men known as Los Titos. And the reason they were known as Los Titos is because Pérez Molina's a military pseudonym was Tito Arias. That's how he was allegedly known in the Highlands during the 1980s when some of the worst massacres of the Civil War occurred. So you start to connect the dots there, and you start to see how Pérez Molina appointed some very questionable figures that he had been linked to for years during the army, and he appointed them and he put them in these key positions, and now these individuals have turned out to be involved in these major corruption scandals.
Now, we've gotten diverted a little bit, and it's my fault, from the impeachment question. As you were noting, a congressman went to the Supreme Court and asked for permission to start procedures that could end in the impeachment of the president. The Supreme Court flashed a green light, then it flashed a red light. And the latest development, isn't it now, the Supreme Court has sort of said, go ahead, give it a try?
Yes. Basically, what happened was Congressman Emilio Pop put forward the motion to start the impeachment proceedings in Congress. The Supreme Court gave that the green light and authorized that to go ahead. But then the Constitutional Court, which is actually Guatemala's highest court and is above the Supreme Court, slammed the brakes on that after two appeals were lodged on behalf of Pérez Molina. The first one was put forward by lawyer Karen Fisher, and the second one was put forward directly by Pérez Molina himself. So the Constitutional Court temporarily said that that it was upholding those two appeals and that the impeachment process couldn't move forward. But of course, there's been a lot of pressure from civil society, and there's been a very negative reaction against the Constitutional Court, because it's not the first time that the Constitutional Court delivers these very questionable verdicts. If you remember, back in 2013, the Constitutional Court reverted the sentence for genocide against former dictator Rios Montt. So once again, the Constitutional Court comes up with this very questionable legal verdict when it said that it would temporarily uphold the appeals against the impeachment process. And then finally, yesterday, the Constitutional Court's final verdict was that it would allow the impeachment to move forward. So the issue returns once again to Congress. And then the way the process works in Congress is that Congress has to appoint a 5-member commission, which is randomly selected by a lottery process. So you have this 5-member committee that is supposed to sit down and analyze Congressman Amilcar Cop's argument and to decide whether there truly are grounds or not to proceed with an impeachment. Then if it decides that Perez Molina could be impeached, then Congress has to take a vote on whether or not to accept the commission's recommendation. And then after Congress has voted, then that's when an ordinary penal court has to decide whether or not it will open a trial against Perez Molina for corruption. So it's a very long and lengthy process. So now it's back in Congress. And the issue there is that the 5 members who are randomly selected to take part in this commission, unfortunately, a number of them are congressmen that are highly corrupt, that have been linked to organized crime. Particularly the president of the commission, Valdivio Ichos, is somebody who's been accused of nepotism, corruption, and CSIC is now investigating him as a result of a number of articles that were published in the local press regarding his involvement in corruption allegations. So he was forced to step down from the commission. And unfortunately, the person who replaced him is Congressman Salvador Valdizón, who's the brother of Manuel Valdizón, who's the main opposition candidate in Guatemala, and who isn't somebody who is known for his transparency and honesty either. So now the focus of public attention has been on Congress, and there's been a number of corruption scandals that have come to light in Congress involving the sale of various positions and openings in Congress. So really, it's been one corruption scandal after another. And
now meanwhile, Luisa, the most visible supporter of retaining President Perez Molina, at least until the end of his term, which will end in January of next year, has been the U.S. Embassy. And in fact, there was a recent press conference I saw reference to, in which Ambassador Todd Robinson stood beside the president, and significantly, the president did almost none of the talking, and the U.S. ambassador did most of the talking about why the president should not be impeached.
Yes, that's correct, and it's something that the U.S. Embassy has been very strongly criticized for. That particular press conference that you mentioned, even on a symbolic level, the fact that you had Todd Robinson speaking and Perez Molina standing beside him with his head bowed, almost like a kid who's been scolded and who's standing there in the corner. I mean, it looks terrible in terms of how the U.S. was very strongly criticized and was accused of intervention, and a lot of people were commenting on social media and saying it's like going back to the 1940s and nothing has changed. So the U.S. has this sort of ambivalent double discourse, as it were, because when CSIC arrested the officials involved in La Línea, the U.S. Embassy published a press release saying that it was happy that Guatemala was moving forward in the fight against corruption and all of this. But on the other hand, it's been very clear that the U.S. government doesn't want Félix Molina to be removed, possibly because it fears that that could be a threat to governance, or it could damage the investment climate. So there's been that double discourse there, and that has been very strongly criticized by the media and by civil society at large.
You know, you mentioned before that CICIG has successfully ended the national opinion that there were people who were untouchable, and has communicated that everybody could be prosecuted for a crime. There is, of course, the countervailing feeling that nobody is safe. A good illustration of that was the recent murder on the street of a man who had been the principal defense attorney both for former President Rios Montt in the trial in which he was convicted of responsibility for literally 130,000, if not more, murders. And he was also the defense attorney for former President Portillo, who, as you say, has now come back to Guatemala after his year in American prison and wants to get back in politics. And I'm sure there are a lot of people who think that the murdered lawyer, Senor Palomo, knows a lot of things that could be an impediment both to Rios Montt's future, but more pertinently to Portillo's future.
Yes, well, I mean, there's an ongoing investigation into the murder of Francisco Palomo, and it's still not clear whether his murder or how his murder was connected to those cases that you mentioned, because Palomo was handling a lot of high-profile cases, so we still don't know whether it was politically motivated or not, or whether it was connected to the cases that you mentioned. The Rios Montt case or the Portillo case, so it's still a matter of speculation. And because he was handling so many high-profile cases, really his murder could have been connected to any of those.
Well, we're going to put these bloody and unfortunate images from Guatemala in our rearview mirror in a moment as we turn south to Honduras, where it should be noted that among the principal demands of the civil society protesters against President Juan Orlando Hernandez is a demand for Honduras to get a Honduran version of CICIG, a UN-assisted investigative crime fighting and police reforming mission. We'll talk about that in a moment, but we're going to take a pause on Here and There. I'm Dave Marish. Our guest is Louisa Reynolds, correspondent based in Guatemala City, Guatemala. We'll be going to Honduras right after these messages.
KSFR programming and podcasts are made possible by the financial support of our listeners. If this program is important to you, please consider making a contribution by clicking on the red Support This Station button at the top of our homepage at ksfr.org.
Welcome back to Here and There. I'm Dave Marish. Our guest is Louisa Reynolds, Elizabeth Newfer Fellow, reporting occasionally for the Boston Globe and the New York Times and the Christian Science Monitor, and most recently, author of an excellent piece that you can access at foreignpolicy.com about the hopes for a Central American spring because of the public disgust with everything that we've been talking about in Guatemala and alarmingly parallel situations in Honduras. What are the bill of particulars against President Juan Orlando Hernandez? And again, it should be noted here that even he is talking about his vice president, Ricardo Alvarez, as a suspect in a large ongoing criminal investigation.
Yes, David, as you rightly point out, there are many striking similarities between the Honduran and the Guatemalan case, and they happened almost simultaneously. What happened in Honduras was that recently the Supreme Court made a change to the constitutional prohibition against presidential re-election, which would pave the way for President Hernandez to seek re-election. So that was something that caused deep concern among civil society in Honduras.
And it should be pointed out that the Supreme Court that made this decision had recently been hand-packed, as they say in the ice cream business, with supporters of President Hernandez, and the four new justices were among those who voted to change the Constitution to allow President Hernandez the opportunity to run for re-election.
Exactly, yes. So, as you pointed out, members of the official party were packed into the Supreme Court. Then they completely arbitrarily decide to change this constitutional prohibition and to pave the way for President Hernandez to seek re-election. Then days later, the Social Security scandal hits the headlines with evidence that millions of dollars from the Social Security Service were diverted directly into the official party's campaign coffers. So that was really, for Honduras, the breaking point. And by then, Honduras had been witnessing on TV and on social media how in neighboring Guatemala, thousands of people were taking to the streets to demand the resignation of Otto Pérez Molina. And so what happened in Honduras was that a lot of people started saying, well, if they could do it in Guatemala, then we should do the same and we should follow their example. And that's when the hashtag resign Juan Orlando Hernández began to be circulated. Because in Guatemala, it was renuncia ya, resign now. And in Honduras, it was renuncia J-O-H, J-O-H, which is Juan Orlando Hernández's initials. So it was almost like a sister movement, as it were, in both countries.
And again, part of the reason for this is that the corruption was not just abstract. People could feel it. Honduras is a desperately poor country and a terribly violent one. But for years, the one functional social service was the medical care and hospital system, which particularly under the coup-ousted President Mel Zelaya had been a fairly competent and fairly restorative place for poor people with medical problems to go. And under President Hernandez, it has literally been drained of resources, is now as useless as the Guatemalan hospital system. And people who could depend on that if they could depend on nothing else from the government of Honduras, when that too was destroyed, there was a real sense of the last straw, and now the crowds are marching through the streets of not just Tegucigalpa, but San Pedro Sula and other cities and towns in Honduras, and they are saying essentially Fuera Joe, meaning President J-O-H, Juan Orlando Hernandez, out.
Yes, exactly. And it's been something quite extraordinary because after the recent history of the coup against Manuel Zelaya in 2009, there's been a lot of fear in Honduran society. And it's been a society that has lived through a lot of repression. There's a lot of repression as well against the press. When you think that over 50 journalists have been murdered since the coup in 2009, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of repression, and that's why I think this is so extraordinary, that people both in Honduras and in Guatemala are losing that fear, and now they've been emboldened by these victories. Because you can say that in Guatemala, forcing Pérez Molina to renew his big mandate was a victory. Forcing Vice President Valdetti to step down was another victory. I mean, it's arguable to what extent did those events happen directly as a result of the protest. But whether or not it was a result of the protest, people feel emboldened by these events. And they feel, yes, we can make a change. We can make our voice heard. And it's been extraordinary that within the context of violence that Honduras and Guatemala are living in, these protests have been entirely peaceful.
I want to get back to that, but I also need to put in a footnote, which is that just as the U.S. Embassy has become the most visible supporter of President Perez Molina in Guatemala, the American role in endorsing and supporting the post-coup governments, which have been universally awful in Honduras, has to be restated, and it's something that you almost never see in the American media. For example, the New York Times has never mentioned the American role in supporting the coup of 2009 in Honduras, and it doesn't mention it today. Hondurans, on the other hand, have not forgotten this.
Yes, that's a very important point to make. And recently, I was very surprised to see in Hillary Clinton's autobiography that she directly talks about almost both about U.S. involvement in the coup against Zelaya in 2009. I mean, I was surprised by how open and how frank she was about that in her book. And as you point out, it's terrible, really, because it almost creates a sense that we're back in Cold War politics, that U.S. intervention in Central America didn't end with a Cold War. It's still very much something that's alive and present, and the coup against Zelaya was proof of that.
Now, the model for the concept of the Central American Spring is, of course, the Arab Spring of Tunisia and Egypt and the rest of the Middle East, which was a short-term revolution and success, but even in the medium term has devolved into a regional catastrophe. Is there reason to hope that there could be a truly and successful democratizing Central American Spring in Honduras and Guatemala?
I would like to be optimistic for Guatemala's and Honduras' sake, and I would like to hope that that can happen, but it's not going to happen in the short term. So it would be unrealistic to think that that all of a sudden in September a brand new government is going to be elected in Guatemala that is going to be honest and transparent and progressive and is going to bring about these amazing changes. I don't think that's going to happen, unfortunately. If you look at the parties running for office in Guatemala, there isn't much to hope for there. And voters realize that. And there's been a widespread rejection, not only of Pérez Molina's government, but also of the political establishment as a whole. And that's interesting to note as well, that in many of the protests, you see people holding placards saying, no te toca, Valdizón, it's not your turn, Valdizón, because Manuel Valdizón, who belongs to the opposition leader party, he's somebody he's a very shady character who's been linked to organized crime in the Northern Department of the DEN. And his campaign slogan was, it's his turn, le toca. So people have morphed that into, no te toca, Valdizón, it's not your turn, Valdizón. So I think the changes that we're going to see in Guatemala and Honduras are going to be more long-term. I think it's the beginning of an awakening process for civil society. As I said before, people feel emboldened by this protest movement. People are not afraid to speak out anymore. So I think there's going to be much more pressure from civil society on Congress, on the court, and that in the long term hopefully could bring about a change.
Meanwhile, all of this upheaval has placed in doubt President Obama's request for $1 billion in aid to rebuild civil society, to create more jobs, to prevent the northward migration of people from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to try and illegally cross the American border. I would guess with all of this going on, one, there is a reasonable question of how sure could you be that that $1 billion would actually be honestly administered and effectively handed out. But maybe more to the point, it's probably dead on arrival in Congress, which is not about to authorize $1 billion to countries in such political turmoil.
Exactly. And also, I think it highlights the issue that it's not just a question of sending funds but or delivering aid. It's a question of rethinking U.S. involvement in the region. And I think that's something that, that involves a whole range of issues, from trade agreements, from trade agreements like BRCAFTA, which have had arguably a very negative impact on the region, to U.S. diplomatic involvement, and things like supporting the coup against Manuel Zelaya. So rather than sending billion-dollar aid packages, I think it's a question of rethinking American foreign policy as a whole towards Central America, and that includes a whole range of issues. And I think that's something that in the U.S. probably sometimes people don't appreciate, or is something that hasn't been highlighted enough.
Well, you know, Americans always quote as if it were a clever witticism, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's description of the elder Tacho Somoza, the first of the family dictators in Nicaragua. He's an SOB, but he's our SOB. That's not regarded as particularly witty or funny in the Central American countries where that kind of policy has its effects.
Exactly. So basically, I would say, instead of sending billion-dollar aid packages, how about simply leaving these countries to find their own political solutions and their own road to development, rather than sending billion-dollar aid packages to stop messing with the region and stop intervening in the region every time that there's a government that you don't agree with.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to declare time on that revolutionary thought, and I think a very good one. That's our story for today on Here and There. I want to thank Luisa Reynolds, our guest in Guatemala City. Luisa, thanks so much for all your insights into these two beleaguered countries.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Pleasure here, too. I'm Dave Marish. Research and production assistance for Here and There is by Amy Marish and Mary Lou Cooper. Operational control by Nick Appalucci. Our theme is by Kate Powell. Here and There is a production of KSFR-FM, 101.1 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You can access podcasts of the program at the KSFR.org website or on iTunes. And you can join us again when next we go Here and There, in search of news.
KSFR programming and podcasts are made possible by the financial support of our listeners. If this program is important to you, please consider making a contribution by clicking on the red Support This Station button at the top of our homepage at ksfr.org.